Conference ID MRO2912 for Richard Olson.
Had a business all the way from, you know, day one back on the farm or back in the city or, you know, back in Hibbing or, you know, how you ended up where you're at, you know, within the UNIVAC Unisys Sperry organization.
Sure. Well, I was originally from Hibbing, Minnesota. And that's where I was born and grew up until I was about 10 years old. And my parents moved out to California, Hollywood. So I actually went to high school in Sherman Oaks, okay, at Notre Dame High School. And my folks worked in the studios out there. My dad was a scenic artist with Walt Disney, and my mother worked for Monogram. And after I graduated from high school in 1953, I went to Hibbing and enrolled in Hibbing Junior College, where I played basketball. And then after 2 years, I got a scholarship to the University of San Francisco, and I played basketball there. And I was drafted in the Army and ended up in Europe, in England and Germany, where I played basketball. And then I got out of the Army in 1958 and got a scholarship to play basketball all in Denver at DU. And after about a year, I decided that I didn't have a future as a professional basketball player. So I went to work and graduated, and I got a BA in journalism. During my last year of high school, I worked at Gates, which was a rubber company, and I was in charge of a hose department where we made hoses for cars and trucks. And I began to read about computers and electronics and decided that was the future. So I quit my job, and so my wife and I at the time, I was married in 1958, and we just celebrated our wedding anniversary of 49 years. And so my wife and I, Judy, moved back, and that was in the summer of 1961. And through a friend of mine in Hibbing, I got a job at what was then RRU, I think that was known as Remington Rand UNIVAC, and I was hired as a planner, production planner on a program that was called ADD, Advanced Digital Device. Later became a computer known as the 1824, a missile computer. And the problem was I was a planner for production, but we didn't have any production. So after a while, the project was canceled, and then I was assigned as the liaison for the engineering and design of a computer called CP667, Mobile Opcon, and then later got involved with a project in avionics that became the forerunner of ANU and P3C, and that's when I first joined the marketing department in 1963. So there we are about 1963, right? So where should I go from here?
Well, let's start your career in marketing. It's even gotten a more civilized label, I guess, now, business development. But
yeah, business development, same thing.
Yeah. What made you decide to leave the production side of it and get into the sales marketing side of it?
Well, I just thought the future was in marketing and sales. If you joined the company, the place that you learned about the company was in manufacturing, but there was no future in manufacturing. And I just liked the style of marketing and the sales. I always enjoyed it, and I liked the travel, and I spent a lot of time in Johnsville in Warminster, Pennsylvania, which was where they did all the design for naval avionics. During about this time, Vern Lee hired a captain that was retired, and his name was Marwood Clement Jr. And he brought in a new word. It was called avionics. And before that, we were basically a Navy house, as you are well aware, and air traffic control. And so we got deeply involved in on avionics, which led us into the PC production, and then later on the VSX, which became the S3A.
On the avionics side of it, you were working, again, mostly mission systems, the back end of the aircraft for both the P-3, or at that time, was it a P-3, or was it still the P-2?
No, it was a P-3. The upgrade of the aircraft, which was originally the P-3A, okay, Lockheed Aircraft, and B, when they were improved and upgraded with digital avionics, that was the C version, okay? And Lockheed was the principal contractor in California, Burbank. And then all the hardware was supplied by the Navy via GFE. So the contracts we have were basically through the Navy. And then we had a contract that handled the liaison with Lockheed, who was not the prime at that time, but was called the principal contractor.
How did your, I was involved just a little bit in the early days, and how did your interface with Eldon Stevens and Dan Brophy work, and what were their jobs?
Well, they were out in Johnsville. They were all in charge of the site, okay? Stevens was the site manager, and Brophy was one of the lead programmers during that time. I was assigned as the marketing guy, and I would go out there for a week at what time. I would leave on Monday and return on a Friday, and so while I was out there, I joined a basketball league, a bowling league. So I was like a part of that scene. So I knew everybody. We had access throughout the base there, and we were able to work the customer, and we're also available to get involved in a wide range of other new programs.
So basically you were commuting to the Johnsville-Warminster area.
Oh, yes. Yeah, and that in those days it was a long trip because you had to fly from Minneapolis to Chicago, change airplanes, go to Philadelphia, and drive up to Schuylkill, and you arrived at Warminster or Johnsville.
Yeah.
But what happened is I was working for Clement, okay, Marwood Clement, who was the head of marketing for Naval Avionics, and I met a bunch of people out at Johnsville and government people, and it was 1 year, it was like March, and so they called me and they said, we are here and the year is ending and we have money to spend and we've got $100,000. What can we buy $1,000? So I looked in my little price book and I said, you can buy a 1244 handler tape unit. And they said, great. And so I gave them the number of the product and et cetera. And so I flew home to Minneapolis and went in to see Clement, my boss. He said, how things go? I said, I sold a 1244 handler tape unit. And he said, you did? How'd you do that? I said, I don't know. I said, I'm just a good salesman. And he said, well, you do understand that in order to buy a tape unit, you have to have a computer. And he said, "I'm afraid that, you know, you were fooled. These guys are fooling you." So I called back out to this guy, and I said, "Joe, what's going on here?" I said, "You bought a mag tape, but you don't have a computer." He said, "Well, no." He said, "We have the tape on order, and we'll use that and justify a computer." And back in the climate, and I said, "Well, here's what's going on." He said, "These guys, you don't understand. You're a junior marketeer, and you don't understand the Navy. And this ain't going to happen." Well, in the next month, they bought a 1230 computer. They bought an I.O. console. They bought a 1004. They bought a motor generator set and all the software. And so I went back and said, "You know what? This is really an easy job. There is no to selling this stuff."
What's so tough about selling this stuff?
What's so hard about selling? And that's a true story. So that was my first big sale. About 1963.
Well, you just have to find their weak spot. And as long as you got a customer with money and desire, that's what's important. How about the next part of the career after that initial foray into the avionics piece with the P3? How about the S3A?
Well, the S3A was a classic because we had a look around at the primes because the Navy decided to buy the program, okay, which was VSX and then the S3A. They decided to buy it as a package, okay? And so they desired a prime contractor. So to win that, it was different because you had to work with a prime. But we were working with McDonald, St. Louis, and our strategy was to get an agreement with them, a teaming agreement. And during the course of events, they acquired Douglas, okay, McDonnell Douglas. And things were hectic. And so we were within a week of teaming with McDonnell Douglas. And I said at the time, I worked for Dwayne Osmond, who worked for Forrest Crowe. And I said, "I think this is the wrong thing, and I think that the winner is Lockheed." So we flew out to Lockheed, and we were all teamed with them. It was a shift, a dramatic shift in strategy, and Kroll believed us, and he was a wise man. Eventually, we won. So that was at the time, the award of the production on VSX or the S3A, as it's now called, was at that time 1968 the largest award ever won by DSC in St. Paul.
What didn't we lose VSX ANU the first?
No, we lost. Johnsville had a competition, and for a computer that was planned to be used on VSX. It was known as AVSAC. And we had a falling out with Johnsville when we teamed with Lockheed, because Johnsville did not want to work with Lockheed. So we lost that program, and AVSAC was won by IBM. And they made three of those computers. But the production was won by us and Lockheed. So it was a very, very hectic time, and you had to really know how to do the strategizing. And we were able to win despite the fact that Johnsville was against us.
And again, it was more at that time, the different Lockheed, even though we're all one big happy family now.
Yeah.
That was they were doing the aircraft airframe, obviously, and then the aircraft integration of the computer, right?
They did the airframe, the systems design, the integration. We did the computer and all of the software.
Okay.
Yes. But fortunately, Lockheed had a lot of friends at NAVAIR in Washington D.C. and they won. Okay, prevailed. So all things worked out good. I think that was the key milestone and helped me out in all my years later on and whatever I achieved in the career I had with DSC, okay, UNIVAC.
The reason I was asking about that the earlier award was because when we lost Alden Stevens and Dan Brophy, and there's a guy named Dave Morris. Do you remember him?
Oh, yeah, very well.
Dave Morris, we went to the debrief.
Yep.
Dave Morris wouldn't fly.
I know that because he would always hop the train.
So he took the train, he rode the damn train, and he got to the debrief when it was half over, and 2 hours later he had to climb back on the train and ride home. But anyway, the reason they took me along was I was working for Clyde Allen those days, and they took me along because they said software was the reason that we lost, and they wanted to make sure that the shit got dumped on the right person.
No, that was not the reason we lost. The reason we lost is that we had a problem with Johnsville over the design of the computer that went in the P3C, the 901. And we had arguments with them. And after that, we did not have a close relationship with the engineers at Johnsville. And they were trying to get rid of us, no question about it. So we lost that politically.
Well, that makes me feel better. That's a long time ago, you know.
But in hindsight, it was a good loss.
It made us try harder then when we lost, right?
Yep.
We had one of those about a year ago, and we're still trying to convince our bosses that it was a good thing that we lost it. It was, well, why did you bid it to begin with? It was a manhood thing. We had to bid it.
Talking about kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyhow, how about the next phase when you started getting more and more responsibilities within the marketing organization?
Well, now I'm director of marketing for avionics, then in 1970, Dwayne Osmond asked me to move out of Salt Lake City as marketing director. And I moved out there, and that place was in shambles. And I got out there, and I said, I have made the worst move of my life. Made missiles and helmet sights and things I didn't understand. And so I shut down the missile business after 1 year. And then I found a group in the back room of engineers that were designing a data link, a wide band data link. And then through the auspices of Gehring, I went to him and I said, you got to reorganize, you know, this place and change the product mix. And the missile business is not good for us and we don't understand it. And so he appointed me the general manager. And this is 1972. And then, to make a long story short, I became the general manager. I worked for Hams at the time, who was the head of program management, and worked for Gehring. And the group out there now, which is a part of L3, is the largest supplier of data links throughout the world. Very, very successful division.
How did, and this is maybe more for my information, how did we end up with Salt Lake City? When did we either acquire or merge that? Was that part of a Sperry deal, or was that previously where Remington ran UNIVAC, or just how did we end up with Salt Lake City?
Well, what happened is Sperry in New York had won the Sargent program, okay, missile program, and it was during the years of Eisenhower. And they were afraid of the Russians bombing, you know, plants. Sperry had to move a plant, okay, production plant, and they had a choice of Phoenix in Arizona or Salt Lake City. And so they moved all of the engineers out of Great Neck, Long Island, and they moved to Salt Lake in about 1953 or 4. And then as the missile business was winding down, they decided to transfer it over and decided that DSD all would be, you know, the group to run it. And so we sent, you know, some people out there to take it over. That didn't go very well. There was a clash of cultures, and all people like Gilbertson. Okay, well, Gilbertson went out there, and he didn't work out. And Keller went out there, and several others. And then I went out there, and I decided that they were people that. We're trying to do the right thing. So I went out of my way to get to know them, and indeed, you know, the people out there were very loyal employees and very competent, and they have proved it over the years. So we made that into a success after about 3 years of faulty you know, starts. So that's how we acquired it.
Okay, I just never heard that, so thank you. Well, how long were you out there? You were out there, what, 3 years in Salt Lake?
3 years. I was out there for 3 years, and then I moved back to St. Paul and worked for Hams at the time, who was the general manager. And then he appointed me as the GM of TSD and the Technical Services Division, which at the time was known as UTS, which was an acronym for UNIVAC Technical Services. At that time, we had about 300 employees. I'm talking about July of 1974.
You went up to what, 2,000?
Yeah. What happened is a lot of people in DSD did not want UTS, as they referred us to, in a derogatory manner, you know, to be there, because we were all encroaching on field sites that they had before. Okay, so the politics were, you know, hectic. So people like Clyde Ellen and others, you know, would call us UTS, and which was a derogatory term. And so what I did is I said, well, I have a way to fix that. And I went to Hams and I said, we are changing the name to TSD.
did that originally evolve into what Pat Casey and John Chislicki were doing in what, 80s or so, 70s, 80s?
Yeah, I was the general manager, and then I hired Casey to be the director of operations.
Okay.
And in 1978, when I was named as the head of marketing by Seaberg, I was replaced by Casey as the GM of TSD, yes.
Okay.
So then I was a VP of marketing from 1978 until 1985 or 1984. Yeah.
So you were heading the marketing organization when we were winning all the big things like the Yuck 43, the Yuck 44, and those sorts of programs.
CPF.
43, Yuck 43.
CPF also.
CPF, the Greek fire control system, submarine system, the contract for the... computer, Navy computer, the AYK-14, you know, the Matkel's display. I could go on and on and on. 1 year we established, you know, what we would do is each year we would have a list of 10 programs, okay, top programs that we focused on. In 1983, we won all 10. Of 10.
It's an amazing feat.
Yeah, it was. It was probably the best year, you know, I had. Well, it was, you know, the best year I had. During that time, we were, the division was growing at a rate of over 20% a year. So we had a very high growth rate, and we lost very, very few programs.
But just what would you attribute, you know, there's a number of things I'm sure you can attribute to, but can you think of, you know, was it the people, the hard work, the customer intimacy, you know, what do you think caused that to happen?
Well, I think what happened is focus, okay? You know, I decided that if we bid a program, we bid to win, and we don't spare all expense or resources. The other thing is we had people who were competent, okay, technically. They knew what they were doing. They were on the leading edge of technology and whatever it was at that time. And they were competent. And we had guys in pricing and contracts. And they were flexible, and they were aggressive, and so what you did is you had a team, a capture team, and their job was you know, to figure out how to go after the program and what they had to do to win it. And the job I had was to give them the resources and the funding that would ensure a very high chance of a win and to back them up all the way. So it was a team effort, and the other thing was we had a process of going through how we decided to bid or no bid, and it was a very elaborate process. And if you weren't able to go through all the issues and items that were on the checklist, we call it, okay, a bid checklist, the answer was no bid, you know. So the philosophy was if we don't think we have a high chance of a win, technically, price-wise, and politically, then we said, you know, goodbye, you know, no bid. And we had the luxury during those years because there were more programs than you could go after. You didn't have the resources to go after all the programs. I mean, it was a happy hunting ground.
Yeah.
It was great years. Those were the Halcon years.
Well, a lot of that's, I mean, a lot of that stuff has still fostered what we're doing today. I mean, after 25 years, we're still looking at, you know, Ole and I are working on something now for the Halifax CPF upgrades.
Yep, it's amazing. I mean, you know, when I was up there at Christmas time, I ran into a person who I won't name, who was telling me that we made a mistake in pricing and winning the Yuck 43 and 4. And we had losses during the years, you know, the first years. And I said to this guy, I said, you know what? There was only one thing worse than winning the 43 and the 44. And he said, what was that? I said, losing the 43 and the 44.
Absolutely.
And because if you look at hindsight, I'm sure, and I don't know this for a fact, but I'm sure they became very profitable programs. And if you look at the profits and the length of what we were involved with on the S3A and the P3C, it's unbelievable. We're talking 30 years or more.
Well, we just
5 years.
Just this last, well, about a week ago, we signed the contract with the Portuguese to upgrade their aircraft, their P3 aircraft, and we're working on another deal with the Taiwanese to do theirs.
Yep.
And we just finished the last, I think, of 72 U.S. aircraft and doing their probably second or third upgrades. And so it's still a huge part of our business up here. It's still 20-30% of our business here in Eagan.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the F-43, I was the program manager on that in the early 90s, and you're right, we were making money, and it was keeping a lot of lights on and keeping a lot of people employed. Sure, the first couple years were a problem, but that's a lot better working those problems than watching IBM try to do it or somebody else try to do it.
That's right.
And that's what would have happened if we hadn't won it, so better to win something and make it profitable than lose it and watch somebody else do it.
Oh, that's, that year, we won the 44 in early 1983. And then we won the Yuck 43, I think, about half a year later. And what our real problem was with those programs is, would there be a problem with the Navy from a political viewpoint if they awarded, after all the turmoil and the freezing of the designs of the Yuk 20 and the 7, would there be a problem politically in the government or DOD for UNIVAC to again win both of those computer systems, okay? So our focus from a marketing viewpoint was to be attuned to solving the problems, not price-wise or technically, but from a political viewpoint.
Do you remember when Parker Folsom was our guy in Washington?
No, he was gone by then. Parker was...
gone by 83?
Huh?
He was gone by 83? When did he...
No, he was not involved in the 43 or 4, Washington.
I'm going to change the subject on you.
Yeah.
Basically. You're going back to about 10 years.
Yeah. We used to have these tutorials for admirals.
Mm-hmm.
And Parker was the person who sat in. I was one of the presenters, Denny Chris, Jim Stage, each... presenter, but then the only people there would be the admiral or the Navy captain and Parker Folsom and whoever the presenter was.
Mm-hmm.
But it was intended to be a tutorial kind of thing to teach them about computers. Now, of course, we can't do that stuff anymore because it's not Cricket or whatever, right? So what kind of support did you get out of the Washington office?
Well, the Washington office, was there mainly that they were people that were there and were meeting the customers day-to-day, okay? Their job was basically to set the stage to bring in the people from St. Paul, the engineers, the contracts people, program management, and to lay the groundwork. So they were, in effect, a liaison group, okay? And the Washington office varied by who the persons were there. For example, Coughlin, okay, Joe Coughlin, who is now deceased, his job was just to hold hands with Don Ream and Eric Swenson. Ralph Hughes, on the other hand, had a background in the Navy, and he could go and make a briefing, a presentation, and was technically, you know, competent. So it varied by the person. So you used, you know, the person based on his skills. So we needed a presence in Washington, and we had one, and I think that they did, you know, by and large, a good job.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I wonder about our Washington presence now, but that's a different subject.
And then, of course, we had a lot of other guys who were down there who didn't work out. But, you know, those what you have to do is weed them out. And we did a lot of, you know, weeding out, and we did a lot of firing and hiring. And what we, you know, try to do is to keep people that were good, that, you know, as I would, you know, say always about a person in the field, you know, if you're out there in the field, you're kind of alone, right? Especially if you're in an office in Boston when you're all alone. And what I would say, you know, about a person wherever he was, whether it was in the Dayton office or the Boston office, is when I woke up in the morning and I was shaving before I went to work, I could think about the guy in Boston and feel good that he was probably doing what he should be doing.
Now, what if you looked at all, you had a lot to do with different marketing people in all different kinds of positions.
Mm-hmm.
Who would you say, excluding yourself, would be the top three that you ever saw working here?
Marketing?
Yeah.
Probably, you know, the top three, I would say, from a wide range of people at the executive level would be Vern Leese, Dwayne Osmond, and Dick Siebert. That was from an executive, you know, viewpoint. We had very competent marketing guys. There were guys that I and Dwayne Osmond would always call the Steady Eddies, okay?
Mm-hmm.
These guys were competent. They knew what they were doing. And guys like that I like to refer to as, you know, Bill Rock and Clint Haggerty, Kurt Rangan, and a lot of others, you know, that just did a very good job, were out there, and they knew the customer. They were specialists in the markets that they worked in, and they were around a long while. If you look at you know, longevity, and you look at guys like again Haggerty and the other people there, you know, John Nygaard, and I could go on and on. There were some, you know, we had some super guys that were there on the line, and you knew every day they were doing something that was right. And they were loyal all employees, and all made a major contribution.
John Spearing, did he leave in, about 81 or 82?
No, John Spearing left in 1983.
Okay, he left in 83.
Yep.
So did he leave before those wins occurred?
No. He left right after that.
Okay.
That was a very unfortunate situation. It had to do, and I won't go into any detail. John and I were good friends. He was a superb, you know, marketing guy, and unfortunately, he had a problem with Seberg that could have impacted his long-range future. And over that, he decided he would leave, and it was
Gene McCarthy, who I consider to be a good marketing guy.
Oh, yeah, as I said, it's hard to name people without, you know, sitting here for a long time. Yeah, I would include Gene McCarthy.
He was the CP140 marketing guy, Shin Pads.
Yep, Knops.
And what's the last one he did, the Australian?
Knops was a very effective marketing guy. Bukovich was a good marketing guy. You know, I could go on and on, so, you know, it's hard to...
With the Canadian Patrol Frigate, even though they're near neighbors, still international, what did you think about the international business and how we handled it? You know, that was one of our first major international wins.
We had a lot of good wins. We did very, very well in Germany.
Yeah.
With the frigate programs and the Schnell boats, okay, fast patrol boats.
By the way, Manfred Wiese, I think you still remember him. He was there, or he just came on board about probably when you were leaving.
I said no. I'm the guy that rehired Manfred.
Okay. Well, he's retiring later on this year.
Yeah. He and I sent emails back and forth.
Okay.
I think in about 19, I don't know, 80, something like that, the guy that ran Germany over there in Bonn, or Bad Godesberg, was a Navy captain by the name of L. Bettis.
Bettis, yeah.
And he worked for Chuck Hammond, who worked for me.
Okay.
And Wiese had left and went to work for a company in Wiesbaden a few years before. And I said to Hammond, I said, it's, you know, a time that we Germanize the division. Why do we have an American there and pay him all these allowances and blah, blah, blah? And so we went down to Wiesbaden and convinced Wiese that he should rejoin the company, and we hired him as the Geschäftsführer, or business leader, you know, in English, and we transferred L back to Washington. And so I'm a very good friend of Manfred's, and have been for years and years. He's a super guy.
Yeah, he is. He's done very well, you know, maintained and continued that business over there, and I think he has a lot of respect within, the, you know, the customer community over there.
Chuck Hammond and I were very close friends, and I still think of him, you know, often. He died very young, as you may know. But
well, Raph, we usually ask people if they want to make some concluding comments about your career and what your feelings were about it. Anything you want to say to kind of tie it up?
Oh, no, I think as I think back over the years, I had a very exciting run there with 27 years. I did a lot of things both in Salt Lake City and St. Paul and the world, Japan, Australia, wherever you want to name it. Worked for a lot of people that I think ISD was fortunate to have as their leaders. Forrest Crowe, who replaced Probst. He was there when we won the first of the major programs like Minuteman and the S3A and the RS3, and Gehring, who managed the programs and made them profitable. Hams, who reorganized DSD in divisions, okay, the International Division and Navy Division and Army, Air Force, and TSD, and what he would say we are geared for growth, and Seabird. And so I had the pleasure of working for all those guys in various capacities, and just had a great career. After the merger, I decided that Sperry was gone, and decided that I didn't want to work with clones like Fred Jenny and L. Zettelmeyer, and I left. And
it was a different place after that.
Yeah, you know, Sperry was gone, and these guys, you know, if you look back and you look at the beginning of 1987 or end of 86, DSD in that area had over six employees, and they should have grown. And now, where are you now? You're probably, what, you know, 2,000?
Yeah, it's right here in town. It's about, well, actually, here in town, it's probably even less than that. It's probably about 1,200 right now. The whole tactical systems division is probably about 2,000 people here, San Diego and Clearwater.
Yeah. So what all happened, for whatever reasons, and I attribute that to, you know, Fred Jenny and El Zetemeyer, is 4,000 people who had, you know, great jobs, you know, didn't have good jobs. I was fortunate because I had a golden parachute, so I was able to leave financially. And but it was very hard to leave after all those years because of the people, not because of the company.
Yeah.
So I always wish everybody there, you know, success. I always enjoyed seeing them. I have no regrets, and I had a good, you know, career, and had the pleasure and privilege of working with a lot of fantastic professional people.
Well, as Ole and I have been doing these interviews, both video and oral and written, we find a lot of people that have a lot of good words to say about you, so the feeling was mutual.
Thank you.
Yeah, Devilak especially, you know, he's not too high on some people, but he said Rappahannock was the best boss. He said it was very clear if you didn't pursue something that was a high probability of a win, you'd be out of marketing in 2 years.
Yeah, well, I always enjoyed working with Roger Devilak because he was always spooling up something.
Roger, you mean Larry?
Huh?
You mean Larry Devilak? Oh, Dodger.
No, I said Larry Devilak.
Oh. Yeah.
We've got to spool this up. You remember that?
You'll be happy to know that he hasn't changed one bit. He is still just as cantankerous and ornery as he was when he was probably 20, 30 years younger.
Well, you know, when I was back there in December, I was in the lobby with Ole, and I ran into Roger Stern.
Yeah.
And he hasn't changed very much either.
Right. No.
Are you going to be able to make it back here in early December this year?
Yeah, probably. I still out here, I still see... Calling, you know, comes out every year, so I see him and a couple others that come out here, and then we have that thing in March, you know, with Wally Emerson.
Emerson.
Yeah. But
yeah.
Other than that, I'm still doing some work with a company in Germany, and work a couple hours a day off and on, and to keep busy and abreast. And And I still do a lot of consulting, you know, in Europe, and so.
So, are you reading the website editions that we throw out there?
Well, yeah.
We got some really excellent ones that are coming.
Yeah.
Tom Soler, and there's this guy we found that was described all the communication stuff.
Well, I just sent an email to you and Lowell, correcting. Oh, there's stuff on the 3760.
Oh.
Now, see, you know, what I didn't mention, and don't include this because it's purposeless, for 1 year I served as the national sales director of CNT.
Okay.
And I was the one that won the Mikado program. Okay?
Yeah.
And I was in charge of that. So Mikado, you remember that?
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
And then after Kroger and Probst, you know, decided to shut that down as a division, Osmond moved to Federal Systems in Washington, and I went back to St. Paul to run TSD. I was there, I think, you know, 9 months or something. So it was very, very intriguing, you know, experience in the commercial world.
It's different.
That too is even back then, but it certainly is a different world than the defense systems piece of it.
Oh, it still is, but you know, the tragedy of that was is Mikado, if we would have gone through and completed that program, that was at the time the world's largest networking service company, okay, McDonnell Douglas Automation. And we would have been the leaders in that business, but
we could have claimed that we started the internet if we would have kept up with that.
That's right, instead of Al Gore.
That's right. The other thing that I think we always didn't really do what we should have is the German Otto Versahn, the voice recognition stuff.
Yeah, well, we you know, the Otto Versahn thing was a little ahead of its day. We were oppressing, you know, technology. And the problem was that we got involved with UNIVAC, Germany, and there were a lot of politics there. Just like if you remember, we had the program over there, which was called
ZKSD.
And the guy over there, Willy Braun, all he wanted to do is make sure we failed, so he would assume control of it. And so so the case of Otto Versahn and good old ZKSD were victims of politics between Bluebell and St. Paul. And that was a tragedy. You know. One of the sides that, you know, you might be interested in is that, and I would not include this in the tape. I had mentioned back we were worried about, you know, the politics of the 43 and 44.
Yeah.
And the admiral who was the source selection authority was Dempster Jackson. You remember him, Ole?
No, you know.
NAV C06. And about 8 weeks before the award, he gave me a call and he says, "I'm going to Greece for a meeting of NATO Sea Sparrow." I said, "Geez, have a good trip, Admiral." He said, "Well, you know, I'm gonna I'll bring my wife along and I want to go on a weekend cruise." And I said, "Well, you know, we've got an office down there. The guy's name is Pierre Iskos, and I'll have him arrange a cruise." And he says, "You know, Rap, you don't understand. I want to go on a cruise with you."
We will leave this part of it out.
Oh, well, he's dead now. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I said, okay, so I get on the airplane and go down there, and I called Iskos before. And so we pick up the admiral and his wife and myself and Iskos and his wife, Rula. And we go down to, you know, the dock, you know, Piraeus. And here's this 85-foot Italian yacht, white yacht. And we get on this yacht, and they've got the crew and everything, staterooms, and off we go, cruising the Aegean. And so the first thing I said, Dempster, I said, "Hey, I don't want to, you know, to get involved with, you know, the 43, but I want to ask you a question when we're alone." So we got alone, and I said, "I want you to tell me that the award decision on the 43 will not be political." And he looked at me and he said, "I can assure you it will not be political. I'm the source, selection authority, and it will be awarded on technical score and price." And that was the end of the conversation.
That's good.
It was a great weekend.
Yeah.
A lot of fun.
What's the temperature today?
You aren't allowed to do that now, I think.
What's that? No, you're not. What's the temperature in Phoenix or in Arizona today?
Well, right now it's about 100 degrees. It's say up there in the winter when it's below zero, it's, you know, a dry cold.
Yeah. You're having some dry heat, huh?
It's supposed to be scattered frost tonight.
Well, we're on the downswing now. Another week and it'll be in the 90s, and then we got, you know, 8 months of you know, heaven. So
yeah. we got the guys working on Legacy, and that's moving along.
Now is the next steps on this thing?
What?
On this right here, what we'll do is, I think we're going to get a tape of this or else a transcript of this, and actually what we'll do is we'll probably both edit it. We'll send it to you, and you can make your comments, and I'm not for sure just what the output of this is going to be, but then we'll, what we're doing is actually, with the tapes right now, we're saving them, and we're eventually, the videotapes, we're eventually going to just take those and probably edit them into short vignettes or shorter pieces, and we'll probably do the same thing with the audio tapes.
Okay, well, I hope I gave you what you were after. No, yes?
That was good.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was fun.
So we got four of them tomorrow morning. Videos?
Yeah, who was?
First one is Valentini.
Good.
Second one is Myron Lacy.
Yeah.
Third one is Howard Nissen.
Yeah.
Fourth one is Phil Phipps.
Phil Phipps?
Yeah.
How old is Phil Phipps?
I don't know. We'll let you know tomorrow.
God, he must be what, about 80?
Must be about 80.
Yeah. Well, you know, make sure, Roy is from Chisholm.
Yeah.
And make sure you give him my regards and Myron.
We were almost going to have Glenn Johnson, so we would have had, you know, the last 2 days, Ole and I would have been rangified.
Yeah, that's right, because...
So I worked on Lacy for 2 years to get him to agree.
Yeah, I've been reading the emails, so that was good. Yeah, you know, Myron went...
And so finally, when he agreed, I saw Glenn Johnson at the picnic, and I said, Glenn, Myron has agreed to have a video, and why aren't you agreeing? So then I called him up and said, what time would you like? And he said, well, I got to go to the lake this weekend, but I'll do it next month.
Yeah, well, these guys, they were a part of a team that was good. You know, I did send an email out to Johnson, okay, Emmett Johnson.
Yeah.
But I guess he's on travel, so I haven't heard back yet. But if I hear back from him, I'll let you know.
He comes up here every once in a while every summer. He still sees his daughter and son-in-law up here. His son-in-law works here.
Yeah.
Well, he was just up here not too long ago, maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Yeah, well, I didn't, you know, recall his son-in-law's name, but I was at the wedding.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, years ago. It was, I don't know when it was, but my wife and I were at the wedding.
Yeah, you better be careful, Rap. If you're going to go into marketing, you got to remember names.
Or maybe not anymore.
Oh, yeah, but a son-in-law, how the hell am I supposed to remember that? Holy.
Well, just keep your, if your Norwegian is keeping you honest, that's the main thing.
Well, that's all, you know, I can still say huna, huna, huna.
Well, she never questioned your judgment because you picked her out.
Well, I've enjoyed this very much. I hope the feeling is the same. Always nice, you know, to talk to old friends, and I hope everything goes well with all the people up there in Egan.
Okay, well, thank you. We appreciate your time this afternoon.
Anytime.
Okay. Look forward to seeing you maybe this winter, December, at the Fort Snelling Club.
Sure.